My name is Jerry, and this is the Wild Eye Podcast. Generations in the Wild. Hi, everybody. I'm a couple of days away from leaving for Svalbard tomorrow, actually. So it's great to have Gabby on board, and she sent me two episodes that I think you guys are going to enjoy. I might pop in between next week, just if I do get some time up in Oslo and Longyearbyen to record a new episode. But yeah, we're in full safari season. The guys are all over the place. I think the next time we're all in the office is only next year, because even at the end of this year, when we have our year-end function, I'm on a trip. Jono's just had a knee op. So yeah, it's interesting times. It's busy. It's going super well. But yeah, for now though, I'm going to hand over to Gabby. And in this kind of personal and heartwarming episode, Gabby sits down with her 82-year-old grandfather, Terry Ashmore. Now, Terry's a lifelong bird lover, a wildlife photographer, a mineralogist, and a chemist with decades of stories to share. So, from early birding in the UK with secondhand binoculars to walking the first Kruger Wilderness Trail in the 1970s, Terry reflects on the magic of slowing down, watching nature with care, and living with curiosity. He shares memories of rare bird sightings, close calls on foot, the joys of handwritten field guides, and his thoughtful minimalist approach to photography. With humor, wisdom, and passion, this episode is a rare glimpse into a quieter and a more intentional way of experiencing the wild, and a touching reminder of the stories that deserved to be passed down. So grab a cup of coffee, grab a glass of wine, and enjoy Gabby having a chat to her grandfather, Terry.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Wild Eye Podcast. In my debut episode, I shared a little bit about my own journey into photography. But I thought, what better way to take you deeper into the story than by introducing the person who started it all for our family? Today's episode is a truly special one. I get to sit down with my grandfather, Terry Ashmore. At 82 years young, he's full of knowledge, stories, and experiences that span decades spent exploring the bush, photographing wildlife, and collecting minerals. He's a lifelong bird lover, a thoughtful wildlife photographer, and a passionate mineral hobbyist, the kind of person who notices the small things most of us would miss. He's walked countless trails in the Kruger, taken just a handful of photos at the perfect moment instead of the hundreds we all do, and filled bookshelves with field guides that tell their own story. Pencil marks, dated sightings, and years of observation, all done the old-fashioned way. Now, I've come to realize just how much there is to learn from his quiet way of seeing the world. And today we're slowing things down to share some of those memories. From Kruger trails to bird watching moments to the life lessons nature has taught him. Granddad, welcome to the podcast. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation.
Thank you, Gabby. I'm quite excited about this. Let's see where we go.
Perfect. Let's get into it. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. When you first came to South Africa, Now what first pulled you into the world of nature? Was it birds, rocks, trails, or just pure curiosity?
Well, it started when I was 8 years old. In the UK, People don't tend to forget that there was no television.
Yeah.
So as children, we went outside into the countryside. And you had to learn about the countryside very quickly, otherwise you'd end up hurting yourself.
Yes.
So at that time, I managed to get a pair of binoculars, ex-army ones that were terrible to view compared with today, but to me it was exciting.
Yes.
I bought a Praktika camera. I won't go back to when I was photographing in black and white with a Kodak, because you couldn't enlarge anything with that. I bought a Praktika with a big lens and spent a lot of time trying to photograph many things. Animals, rabbits, badgers, and bird life. And the interesting thing is the bird life in the UK that I saw at that time was prolific. There was you could go out in a day and see maybe 20 species, from linnets to bullfinches, you know. But the problem was, you couldn't actually identify a lot of them when it was new, because books was something we couldn't afford. There was nowhere where you could actually go, and a library maybe, but to own your own bird book, that was quite an achievement. So in those days, managed to take quite a lot of photographs, a lot in black and white, but there was no way to edit them like you can today. They came out exactly as they came out. So at that point, even in the UK, I decided that I would process my own photographs. So I bought all the darkroom equipment, enlargers, and did quite a lot of processing, which was very expensive and, to be honest, not very successful. You know, so that's where I started. I eventually ended up in South Africa, which I was headhunted as a consultant. And when I came here, I didn't really know a lot about South Africa, but what I did know is that wildlife and birds must be great. But so at that time, that's really where it started. Came here and had to work all hours. But in my free time, I joined the Wildlife Society, and who had meetings in Johannesburg. There was even a birding club in Vereeniging. Yeah, mainly full of old people then. And of course, I was one of the youngest. So that's really where it all began. And the golden opportunity for me to go, first of all, walking in areas that you can't walk today. But certainly not the excitement of going to the parks. And the Kruger Park at that time was the golden opportunity for anyone. The camps were basic. The whole atmosphere was different, totally different. The bird life was good, but the animals were a lot less than they are today. So to see a lion or an elephant, you could go 3 days, 4 days, 5 days and not see one. But you could always see the birds. And I was always very, very keen on trees and, you know, the actual bush, insects, butterflies and all the rest of it. So that kept me busy in those days. And it developed from there. I brought my family out, my mother and father, and they thoroughly enjoyed it. I had two young girls who sat in the back in the heat, no air conditioning. People forget about that. At one time it was 46 degrees at Skukuza. And there we were sitting in costumes in the car, perspiring terribly. But that was a learning curve. And having gone to the Kruger Park, we didn't go very far north, because in those days to drive to the Kruger Park wasn't the freeways you've got today. It was an epic journey. So that's really where it came about.
I think, like, I know with me, we often, as the youth, we don't see everything that you had to experience. I mean, now with having apps and all of these things at our fingertips, I've never thought of not having a bird book, like not being able to afford to identify the birds. And that, you saying that, I think a lot of our listeners will also, like, take a step back and be like, I've never thought of it that way. So that was, thank you for sharing that. It's really eye-opening. But now, you've always said that there's something different about being on foot in the bush. So let's look at the many trails you've done. Do you remember your very first bushwalk in Kruger? What was that experience like for you?
Well, at that time, the Kruger Park were experimenting. They were talking about doing bushwalks in wilderness areas. They also decided that they needed to take people who, let's say, would be disciplined. Because no one was quite sure what to do. So I think my first walk was arranged very early on, going into the Volhouter Trail. And it was members of the Wildlife Society and friends. I think there were six or eight of us. And we met in Skukuza We were briefed by a ranger called Trevor Dearlove, who was a pioneer in walking trails. Mm-hmm. And we talked for a while about what they were trying to do. They did explain what we had to go through.
Yeah.
But as we were quite experienced in the bush, it wasn't a worry.
Mm.
You know, there was a ranger and a tracker, both armed. So there we were with our little backpacks, set off from Skukuza in a Land Rover, and then turned down as we were going back towards Pretoria's Kop, turned south, down one of those roads you're not supposed to go down.
Yes. Yeah.
And we drove for quite a while, saw quite a few things on the way, and then eventually got to a small, looked like a farm gate. We went through it, and we were at Valhuta Camp, which was tents, a fire, I think someone there cooking, and that's how it all began.
That's incredible. Okay. But now, what was it about being on foot that changed the experience for you compared to sitting in a vehicle?
Well, when you're sitting in your car,
you
feel very safe.
Yes.
You know, you make a lot of noise, your cameras are there, everything is safe.
Comfortable.
You're comfortable. Very comfortable.
Yeah.
In the bush, the first day we got there, there were animals around, and what we found was they were curious about us. And the other thing is there were a lot of dangers that we weren't aware of. Thorns, terrible thorns,
yeah.
Rocks, sharp rocks. Trees that you get to know that had thorns or were dangerous.
Mm.
So we went through all these talks, and the object was to get a bush experience. And we were told at that point that we might not see any animals because we are so clumsy in the bush that you see an animal 200 yards away and it's gone.
Yeah.
But what we did learn was the bush, the love for the bush, the trees, the plants, the custom uses for all the plants.
Mm,
the heat was something that you don't realize. And we walked on the first walk a lot, 18 kilometers a day at least.
Sure.
So we were exhausted. Mm. We had a picnic when we went out, we came back, we sat under the stars. That's when I saw my first pennant wing nightjar.
Oh, wow.
And the nightjars were calling all around us.
It's incredible.
And the stars were magnificent.
Mm.
That's the bush.
Yeah.
No light.
Yeah.
And we retired to our camp beds in the tents. I don't even remember having mosquito nets at that time. Maybe we did, I just can't remember. And that's really how it began. And we learned to be cautious. We learned to stay in a straight line, to be quiet.
Mm.
And signals were given, hand signals, which we had to learn. And we were told, no matter what happens, don't break rank. And there was a ranger in front. In the first one, it was Trevor Dearlove. There was a tracker at the back, Yarpie, both with rifles, that were so intense that they wanted to make sure these trails would be successful and no one would get hurt. Well, we got a few scratches and things, but no one did. And that whole trail introduced me to a lot of things, including the rocks, the geology.
Yes.
There's a whole load of insects we learnt about that we'd never knew. A lot of uses for plants, from toothbrushes to you know, toilet paper. All of that made it very special. And so when we got back, I found it exceptionally exciting and went immediately to Trevor, who had lived in Skukuza, and said, we want to come again, and I'm going to bring one of my friends in the UK.
Okay.
And that trip was where totally different.
Now moving on to the next question, where I think you're going to give us a bit more info on that. Was there ever a moment on a trail that really stopped you in your tracks? Something you saw, heard, or even felt that stayed with you all of these years?
There are several.
Okay,
but the one that stands out, on the second walk, we were walking in a gully, in a straight line, and all of a sudden, we could hear this crashing of bushes and this thunderous noise coming towards us, but we couldn't see what it was.
Oh, goodness.
The ranger said, get behind the tree. Well, there was one tree about 30 centimetres, which we all tried to stand behind. This all happened in seconds. Through the bush came, I think it was three, in my better stories it might have been four rhino, flat out, charging straight at us.
Oh my goodness.
The ranger went down on his knees, only about 30 yards, and started firing into the feet of the... And they just kept coming. The ranger at the back ran sideways, and he started shooting across, and they fired seven shots.
Oh, wow.
And the rhinos ended up... We were just, you know, we must be safe. We didn't know afterwards that we weren't as safe as we thought.
Yeah.
But anyway, they stopped. They kicked the dust.
Mm.
No one moved. The ranger in front never got off his knees. And he was 15 metres away.
Wow.
And at that point, they calmed down and they wandered off sideways. Mm. They were white rhino. And then everyone was in shock, including the rangers, although they tried to show it. They had never had this experience. So that was the one. When there's time, I can give you a few more. On exactly the same walk, we went to a dam and we parked the Land Rover. It was further away. We parked the Land Rover and decided to have a picnic on a little promontory on the dam. And there was a hippo in the dam and he was looking at us and so on. So we'd got our sandwiches out and we put everything out and we were drinking our drinks. And all of a sudden, the tracker said, "Run! Back to the Land Rover." All I can remember is, now, in a panic, all I can remember is turning round and running. As I turned round, I could see this wave coming towards us in the water.
Oh, goodness.
We only had to do about 50 metres. And you'd be surprised how quick you can run when you're told to run. And we eventually got, before we got to the Land Rover, the hippo came out the water, straight up onto the promontory.
Oh, wow.
And we got back and we watched him. And he decided to destroy all our camp stuff. So he was kicking it and throwing it around and bags and everything. Eventually went back in the water. We took the Land Rover a bit closer and we gained everything we could. You know, we squashed corned beef tins and all kinds of things. But that particular trip, there are several other instances that I won't mention at the moment that tells you it can be dangerous. And I never had any of those experiences again, but they were all on the one trip.
That's very interesting. Okay. Now, let's continue this kind of trend about talking of bushwalks. So, for someone who's never done a bushwalk, how would you describe the magic of it? Why should they try it at least once in their life?
Well, if you can do a bushwalk, you'll be one of very, very few that are able to do it.
Yes.
I'm not talking about going out in a small camp. We're talking about staying three or four nights in a tent and everything is provided.
Yeah.
There is a whole new experience. I would do them all the time, but they're often fully booked. There have been quite a lot of people who have been on the walks and complained, I'm afraid. So we were told at that time that if you're going to have a group, you have to find out so you know each other.
Yeah.
Very important that. You don't want a stranger.
Mm-mm.
Because whatever happens, no one must break. And the other walks were just wonderful adventures. Talking round the campfire, bush food, birding, not easy unless they come and land on your nose or something, you know. You do get to hear with a ranger a lot of birds in bush that you wouldn't know. And in those days, there wasn't recordings.
Yes.
But the ranger or the tracker could make the bird calls themselves. They could call the birds in.
That's insane.
And that was fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, it was certain woodpeckers. Easy on the owls, of course. But a lot of birds are really quite, at that time, you learn, are very, very territorial. And at that time, they said they don't do this side. It's called unethical now, but everybody does it a little bit. You hear it all the time in the camps. That magic, I then started studying a lot of the other things that are there. The mammals and habits, I bought the textbooks, which, as you know, you've got one, in those very early days that were zoology books. they weren't available to the public.
Yeah.
The early guides, which were useful, that people, I don't think, remember, I may have one or two, is the Kruger Park issued books. I've still got some on frogs, reptiles, insects, mammals, birds, common birds, little booklets. And then you got a guide with little photographs of the main birds, and that's how you learnt it. Because I've got an early Roberts. But Roberts is very difficult in those days. Unless you were an expert, you couldn't follow it.
Yeah.
The classifications and Latin names, which was wonderful for, you know, the professionals.
Yeah.
Not much use to amateurs. So that's really what you learnt. And you also learnt to be safe, which when I did a lot of prospecting and came across a lot of animals, including snakes,
yeah,
areas that were dangerous, you learnt to look, don't walk with your head down. Mm. Look, listen. And that was when I was on my own,
yeah,
in areas where there were leopard. But I never had any problems with them. So learning the bush law, learning to look at an animal and understand whether it's a threat or not. On one occasion, white rhinos were never thought to be a problem.
Yeah.
But on one occasion, we were walking, and the ranger, the guide said, let's go on top of this ant hill.
Yeah.
So we got seven people up on top of the ant hill, you see. And it was quite steep, but we got up there. And he said, that rhino there is too curious. And we actually stood there when the rhino walked nearly all the way to us, walked around and walked off.
Sure.
Now he sensed that, and we learned to look at a rhino if it's feeding and so on, and learn when it's alert and it's not sure. That type of thing. You do the same with lions, but everybody's been on foot with lions, you know, and they just run off. But I've never got only one experience where it was dangerous, but that wasn't in Kruger. It was in Botswana.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But that is very interesting about learning the whole behaviour and stuff like that.
Yeah. The other thing that was important, though, is that the walks, at the end of the walk, you had to have an inquest. You had to, in those very early days, what did you do, what can we do, and so on. And at the inquest with the animals, when we had the problem with several animals, Mike English was there. And we had to do a lot of talking. Every person who went had to say, what do they think happened that those rhinos charged? And what came out of it is that the rhinos didn't charge, they were running away.
Oh.
But when they broke through the bush, we were in the way.
Yes, that's interesting.
The aggression was not to us, there was fear on, you know, and so they had to be very careful about that. And with the hippo, we had an inquest on the hippo because that hippo had never done that before.
Yeah.
And it was a male in a dam, and the inquest came out and said, that male is getting possessive, name was Horace, we must never take guests near that again. And they didn't, we were the last time. And I did hear that Horace was shot on a few trails later, may have been a few months later, when he was encountered in the bush, not in the dam.
Goodness. And what year was this in, around like the time?
Well, the first ones were in 1978, and I did several walks between 78 and 80. But after that, it was a lot more sophisticated.
Yes. Okay, so now you're...
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, now moving on to another passion of yours.
Mm-hmm.
Birds have always been a part of your life, not just seeing them, but remembering them. Now, do you have a favourite bird memory that still makes you smile when you think of it?
Most of the memories were seeing a bird we couldn't identify.
Mm.
What I didn't realise is there are so many morphs of birds, and that no books or anything gave us those. And we spent hours
trying to ID
black falcons that were totally wrong. Mm. You know, white falcons or part white. And there was a lot of birds at that time that were not exactly the picture that we had in the guides.
Yes.
And there were no photographic guides.
Mm.
So identifying brown bird was done on a description. Now, when you're talking in Latin of the primary feathers and the rest of it, we hadn't got a clue what that was about, you know. So other than birds that had bird calls,
yeah,
or the rangers helped us, bird watching was very, very difficult. What I can tell you on that is that my colleague who came out on one of these trips was an avid birder in the UK. He's one of those guys that jumps in his car and drives 400 kilometres to see a swallow, you know. And he was so keen to come,
yeah,
birding was more important than animals to him, that he actually had got old tapes, the old cassette tapes, which is all we had. And he'd got recordings that he'd got from people who had been to South Africa or Africa, and had recorded. In those days, people used to come out and just record birds. Birders recorded birds with all the equipment.
Yeah.
And he studied the bird calls of a lot of the birds. And when he came here, he'd studied them so well that when we were walking, he would say, oh, that's a chagra. That's a particular golden woodpecker.
You're not even from here, but you know all these bird calls.
Yeah, no, but he did. He did. But that shows you, even in those days,
yeah,
birding was a lot more mysterious, but still fascinating.
Yes, yes. Now tell us about what you just told me earlier about that lilac-breasted roller. I want to hear that story. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, well, when you're looking at memories, the one that stands out the most is that we were somewhere near Oliphant's camp.
Okay.
And there was a lilac-breasted roller, and it was quite close. It was quite densely bushed. It was quite close. And of course, we grabbed the cameras. In those days, we had not electronic cameras,
yeah,
still film. But when it's in the sun, you're falling over yourself. And I had a 200 lens I'd just bought, and it was all fixed, no automatic.
Yeah.
You had to set the exposures, use an exposure meter. And I was looking at this lilac-breasted roller, and I took one shot, and as I went to take another, a lion came up right in front of me, and all I saw was the nose and eyes of a lion. We fell over backwards. It looked as though it was right next to me. And it actually was about halfway to the roller.
Dang.
So that was something you will never forget.
Wow. Oh my goodness, it's so great hearing all of these stories. But now, you've told me before, you used to log sightings the old-fashioned way, with field guides and notes. Now, do you still peek through those pages sometimes?
I've still got all the old books, some of them quite crude. You know, some of the guides from the Kruger Park. Etosha, guides from Etosha, a little book showing the birds of Etosha, and Kalahari birds and Karoo birds.
Yeah.
I've never spent so much time with seabirds because I didn't really go to the coast that much. And I've always found it difficult, all the little brown bird.
LBJs,
yeah. But once you get into the bush and you get to know what's in an area, then it doesn't take you long to distinguish which of the 24 larks are the one that you've got in the area.
Yeah.
And that was the biggest gain. But still, photographing birds was for the professionals. It really was. And although I could do developing, it still didn't look like the photos that were in magazines like National Geographic and so on. Those guys were real photographers,
yeah,
no electronics. They would spend, and I saw some of them, a week trying to photograph one bird.
That's insane.
Yeah. So that was, I think, the difficult side of it. But at the time, we didn't know any better.
Yeah.
So it was fun. Now you want to try and see 200 birds in a day, but you don't spend enough time on the habits of one little bird, which we did.
Yeah, that's the difference now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, now was there ever a bird you waited years to see? One that felt like a personal quest that you finally seen it?
Well, there are two birds I've never seen.
Okay.
So, and that means one's a Nerina trogon that I went into the Knysna forest and walked for 3 days following the call, which is distinctive, and never saw it. I did the same in the north trying to find a Pell's fishing owl. And every time we saw it fly off as we got close, we couldn't see it properly. Those are the two birds.
So you have seen a Pell's fishing owl, you just couldn't really appreciate it. But you did see it fly away.
Yeah, but that's not what I wanted. You're a photographer. You know, you need that proof.
Yes.
Even if it's a little bird in a big bush, I still take photographs as a record.
Like a record shot. That's what they're called.
Yeah,
nowadays.
First shot, a record shot, and then you try and get on. It's so much easier to take photographs now.
Yeah.
You have to take them in flight or any kind of ridiculous antics they're in. Trying to photograph Qurans diving down and so on.
Yeah.
You set yourself different targets.
Mm. And now tell me, have you ever seen an African pitta?
An African?
Pitta.
No.
No.
Very pretty.
Very, very pretty bird.
No, no. But I didn't even know about those.
Yeah.
A lot of the birds that we were trying to see, it was difficult enough identifying, say, 50 birds in the Kruger Park.
Yeah.
Going through books. And I've still got books with pencil writing all across,
yeah.
Very old Kruger Park guides with pencil writing on the side with a date and Shingwetsi and so on. And then not sure it was this one, but it could be such and such. And unless we were sure, we weren't allowed to keep it. So there was a lot of birds that we didn't.
You saying that now has just sparked up a memory. Remember the very first time that we went to Shinzela?
Yes.
The very, very first time. And you and I were walking around camp. It was still unfenced at the time. Walking around camp, and you were teaching me how to identify trees. Do you remember that?
Identify what?
Trees.
Trees, yes. Yeah.
And I had this book. I think you may have given it to me.
Mm.
That book with all, I forget the name now, but it had frogs, it had insects, it had every trees, grasses, everything.
Yeah.
You know, ferns and stuff. I think you remember what I'm talking about. And there was this one tree that we identified, and you still took a leaf from it and put it in the book and put it as book rock. Remember that?
Yes.
I was scrolling through that book and I found that, and I've still got that exact leaf from so many years ago. So with all the scribbles in the page.
But I went on from the leaves to studying African trees, the history and what they were used for, the original use of African trees in ox wagons. That's a story in its own right. Absolutely fascinating how you'd have an ox wagon that was a Rolls Royce ox wagon, and you'd have another ox wagon that was a Ford ox wagon, and the Ford would get halfway up the mountain, and it depended on how much money and where you bought these wagons from. Again, it's a knowledge. Now, of course, you're not allowed to cut some of those trees down.
Yeah.
Well, you can, but depends, you know, if it's felled or so on. But there is a lot of timber used, if you think of yellow wood and so on, that now has become very valuable because you can't cut the yellow woods down.
Yeah.
And yellow wood isn't even a very good tree for furniture, because if you move it into the Transvaal area, call it Transvaal or Gauteng, it shrinks and it cracks all over the place. So there is a lot that springs from. An inquiry is a bird. If you see a bird eating a seed, you then have to know the tree.
Yeah.
Now you can look at the bird and it'll say that it's got a favourite, like a green pigeon, a favourite tree. A favorite, and you can actually know that. In those days, we wrote notes.
Very interesting. So, the whole history. Love it. Now, I remember you once told me about how twitching worked in the early days. Before all the WhatsApp groups and apps that we now rely on, what was the process like back then when you spotted a rarity and wanted to let your mates know that, hey, I've seen this bird? It must have been a mission.
Well, the first thing is, just about every bird was a rarity.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't been here very long.
Yeah.
And other than a Roberts guide and a few others, there wasn't any of these other guides. And you didn't get photographs of, say, eagles in flight or vultures in flight. So you had to learn all that by watching them and taking your own photographs. And then you realise that they all look different. Tawny eagles, I've never seen so many different tawny eagles, even today. Fish eagle, wonderful. Everyone can recognise it by its call.
Yeah.
But not many people can recognise any of the other eagles.
Yes.
It's surprising. So I think I've lost the train there. What we were talking about?
We were talking about when you spotted a rarity, how you'd let your mates know.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, we couldn't get photographs and couldn't get them developed.
Yeah.
We were on colour slides, and colour slides are beautiful, but I could never afford the cameras, the lenses and so on. In those days, it was way out.
Yeah.
The quality was good, but so what we used to do is go into the shop and find a photograph of a lilac-breasted roller, right on the back. saw this today and post it back to England.
That's so sweet.
And it would get there in a week or two.
Not like nowadays. I don't even think it.
And obviously, most of the stories and most of the information is spread just like this.
Yeah.
You would sit round a campfire and you would talk about, what did you see today?
Yeah.
How do you know it was like that?
And that's exactly,
you share the experiences with people who are all keen to learn, instead of, take a photograph. Oh, look, it's a Quran.
WhatsApp message or something like that.
So sometimes I think you've got to put your things away, find one bird, and then watch it for an hour. Everything it does.
Slow down. I think that's the main thing.
Yeah.
We're going to take away from this.
And don't set yourself challenges. Because, and I've seen this so many times, people have said, we saw 100 birds in the Kruger during our time. I say, wonderful. You know, did you watch them? Well, no, as soon as we got one, we write it down and we go. And then you go to another one, got that. It's a different approach.
Yes.
It's twitching. It's more to do with putting a mark than it is
ticking
in actual enjoying the birds.
Yeah. Okay. And for our listeners, we were talking about sitting around a fire chatting. We're now sitting in where Mom grew up. My mother grew up and we're sitting next to the fire and we're chatting, and this is what it's all about. So that actually brought me to my next question. Do you think we connect more deeply with birds when we're not trying to tick them? And I think you just answered that question.
Yeah, I did. The birds were never a threat. The initial trails were to learn about the bush and learn how to be safe in the bush. Birds, as far as the foot trails, to see birds in any situation when you're walking, unless you're following a call, is very difficult. Birding came in more when we went to the Kruger Park and we used to go around the camps, or you'd suddenly come across an area where you often get these, where there's a prolific amount of different birds flying around everywhere. You stop there and they'll be there for about 20 minutes, half an hour. And what you did learn is the number of birds that flock together.
Yes, the bird parties.
Different species, yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. I know something that's said now is that in most bird parties, there's often a pearl-spotted owlet that attracts many birds. So often you'll find that when there's a pearl-spotted owlet, there's a bird party around it. And when a pearl-spotted owlet calls, then a lot of birds come together and then form that bird party.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting.
Well, we had one situation where we heard a call and the ranger said, that's a barred owl. And I thought, wow, yeah, that's magic. He said, but it's a baby barred owl. Kind of squeaky sound it was. And we followed it, and we were watching the baby bird, small, on a branch, through the bush, and all of a sudden it was zapped by a falcon.
We're
not even sure what the falcon was. I think it was a goshawk from the flash. And it hit the bird, and wham, it went down deep into the bush.
Wow.
And I know it's probably not considered ethical, but the ranger at that time, we were in Sabi Sand, he said, we can't leave it down there. So he got out and he picked up this stunned little bird deep in the grass that didn't look too healthy. And he picked it up, and I had a camera bag, and we put it in the camera bag and we took it back to the camp, and he looked after it for 2 days, and then he said, we got to take it back. It was now sitting upright again. And we went back to the same area. It's a lovely story, this. We went back to the same area. We put the little bird on a branch, not the same one, but, and he did the call, or the tracker did the call of the barred owl. He did a few calls, and would you believe it? The parents came down on the branch next to it.
Aww.
2 days after we'd found it.
That is so special.
You know, and it was just such a lovely touch. And I've got a wonderful photograph of it in a camera bag, this little thing looking at me.
That is so special.
It was about,
special.
I don't know, 10 centimetres or so, tiny. But that's the thing about birds. It's what happens. We know it's nature.
Yes.
But then again, you've got a soft spot sometimes, and we all said, no, we can't leave it.
You know. That is so cute.
But he didn't think he could save it.
Yeah.
And it's quite common now for people to find birds like that and take them to a care centre.
Yeah.
So it's not unusual now, but in those days,
it was quite.
Yeah.
Now, with us on the topic of bird calls and stuff like that, is there a specific bird call that takes you straight back to Kruger whenever you hear it? I know I certainly have one.
The pennant wing nightjar was the first time I ever heard, and I can't even remember what the call was because it's so different. It's like a whistling sound, I think, but I've never seen one since. And I do believe in those days, in the south of the park, they were very rare. And now I don't know where in the park you can see them. I think in the north.
Yeah, Punta Maria area.
Okay. But to have them flying over the campfire while we were sitting there in our chairs.
That's insane.
And the other nightjars as well.
Yes.
There were three different nightjars we saw there, or heard. That to me was a thrill, because in the glow of the fire, to see this thing, it almost looks white,
yeah,
against the sky. Slowly drift around.
Beautiful.
That's one of the memories. I mean, I'd have to think about a lot of the others, because there's so many.
There are many.
Yeah.
You have lots of stories to tell.
Mm.
I would say mine is also nightjars, just sitting around the campfire listening and just hearing them. But also, like you mentioned earlier, the African fish eagle. That's just so Kruger. The woodland kingfisher as well. But you are, there's so many.
Photographing the malachite, such a small bird, but now I've got stunning photographs with the modern equipment I've got. I mean, it just stands out.
Yeah.
And I've got one particular photograph of a white-faced owl against the black sky.
Wow.
It's stunning, absolutely stunning. You know, it just hits you, taken with flash. And taken with flash, you don't know whether you're focused or not.
Yes.
But I've got you could put it on the cover of a magazine.
You're going to have to find that so I can see it.
No, I know where it is.
I'll have to see that after this. Mm. Okay. But now, we're talking about photography, so let's move our focus a bit to that. You've always had such a different approach to it. How did you develop your wait for the moment style? Because I remember our early days in Pilansburg with Chris and Dave, and we'd come back from drive and we took hundreds and thousands of photos where you only took a few, but they were all perfect. Tell us how you developed that.
Well, it's actually quite easy. If it's a new bird, I take one shot. And then, having done photographic courses, I will then watch a violet waxbill. I will watch it for half an hour until it's in a position that it's actually facing me with a glint in the eye. I just won't take other photos anymore. But a lot of that comes from the early days when you used a slide-up. You didn't take a photo unless it was really good or it's a bird that you've never seen before.
Yeah.
But I've hardly got any birds in slides. I've thrown them nearly all away, you know, because you couldn't do the skill. You couldn't edit it. It's as it comes.
Yeah.
You send the slides away, it arrives back, and that's what it looks like. And the fact that you've got a white branch going through it, or the depth of field was too big because the lenses were different then. And that depth of field, short depth of field for bird photography, is everything.
Yes.
Must stand out.
Okay, now is there an image that you've taken that for you says everything about why you love photographing wildlife?
I've got so many now. I have hundreds of fantastic photographs, from close up to, I will photograph a bird's head now, just the head, and see the whiskers and things. And animals, well, I've got favourite animal, it's a leopard. And I must
why,
have...
Why is that? Why is it a leopard?
Because I've had experiences with leopard, which is another story, but I have come across them in the bush and they just looked at me. I've had one running between me and the guy in front in reeds, straight across. And the most amazing one was in the Sabi sand, I think. But we stopped and there was a leopard on a rock. And we stopped and we were looking at it. And this is very early days. And all of a sudden it stood up. So I started to take a photograph and he jumped down onto the, between the driver and me, onto that wooden plank, polished wooden plank. It jumped down onto that and off.
That's insane.
Now that was heartbeat moment. But that, the idea that the leopard, they're very aware of you, even in a vehicle. I can tell you that lions might not know, but I believe leopards can see all of you. They're not stupid. They will actually hunt alongside the vehicle as you're driving.
Yes, they're so clever.
Yeah, no, they know. And they're such beautiful animals. They're majestic. And they're still not easy to photograph in. And their eyes, when they look at you, are just magic.
Yes.
So I like the leopard. I like all animals, but particularly the leopard or one of the other cats. You know, but not lions.
Interesting. I also like leopards. Lions are, I find them a bit difficult to photograph.
Leopard?
No, lion. I don't know.
They're boring. To me, a buffalo is one of the most difficult animals to photograph so that it actually looks good. It's so plain. They look better in black and white than anything. Yeah.
I do agree with that. Now, do you remember the first time? I'm moving on to like rocks and minerals now because that's another passion of yours. Can you remember the first time you picked up a rock or mineral and thought this is something special?
I've done that a lot. From the Namibia was my first experience of finding rocks and rock formations that was special. But I collect crystals, and crystals generally can only be mined.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to go down the mines, or you've got to get them from miners, which I've got, or you have to buy them, because crystals, if a crystal's on the ground, unless it's quartz, it gets damaged. So yes, you can collect rocks. I've collected, in one occasion, I found several Bushman axes and arrowheads, which I handed in to a colleague of mine who's head of paleontology at WITS. So you get to recognise when a rock is in the wrong place. How did this get here? And then you realise it's come all the way from the Karoo to here, and someone has been chipping at it. Bushman.
That's
something when you're in very remote areas, even if there's nothing there, such as the Namib or the Kalahari, yes, there is. There's stuff everywhere.
And that's what I think is so special about the way you see things, because like we were talking about birding, spend an hour watching one bird and how it behaves. And I think that's something that today we don't often do because it's always a rush. And like even with the rocks that you're talking about, you notice these things that the average person won't. And I think that's why it's so inspirational having this conversation and spreading kind of the awareness of slowing down, because we don't do that enough. And I think it's so, so important that we do.
Yeah, it is. And I think with young people, even old people, you know, you tend to see a lot more elderly people in the game parks. And I think the reason is that they enjoy the atmosphere. Young people can see everything on the TV, and it all looks an awful lot better than when you're looking through the window and the animals, the lions, are in deep grass. You get fed up. So if you want to teach children or young people, you need to take someone with them that can tell them about, did you notice that butterfly there? You need someone who could say, did you know that lions do this or lions do that? And they sleep 90% of the time.
Yes.
Like you do. Yeah, but that's the thing. So birding is a good start. Trees and grasses and rocks are very difficult. And in fact, in the associations I'm in, such as the Geological Association, it's all full of doctors and professors and some amateurs. There are very good amateurs that discover a lot of things, the same as astronomy. I've got a telescope, I've studied astronomy, and I belong to the Astronomical Society. And those people spend days and hours looking for stuff. And they're the ones that find planets or comets, not the professional. And when it comes to mineralogy, the universities now do very little study for scientific purpose. So what I do is scientific purpose, paragenesis of minerals. You can find it in very old books, or you can do it yourself. You can test it yourself. But if you go to a university, and I've spoken to many a dean, they say, oh, we can't do that.
Yeah.
If it's not commercially viable, it won't be analysed. So as an amateur, we have to pay to have a new mineral analysed. And sometimes a professor will do it for us if it can be his name.
Oh.
That's different.
Yeah.
So most of the knowledge we gain
Yeah.
is shared amongst ourselves with great excitement. But very, very few other people would understand it. But that doesn't mean to say you shouldn't study it.
Yeah.
It's like cooking. A lot of people do cooking and, yes. and cooking lessons and so on. You become enthusiastic and there's like 50 ways to cook a potato.
Yes.
So unless you're really fascinated with it, it doesn't matter to you. And that's the same with bird life. You know the old saying in the park where a car pulls alongside you and says, "What have you seen?" I say, "Whoa, there's this bird here." "Oh, a bird." Carry on.
Drive off. Yeah.
Yeah.
But now, have you ever come across something in the bush, be it a rock formation or an outcrop, that made the geologist in you stop and stare in wonder? If so, where and what drew you to it?
Well, because of my knowledge, then I see it everywhere. There's some wonderful rock formations in the Kruger Park.
Yes.
You can see them in the riverbeds. They call gneiss or gneiss, it depends how you want to pronounce it. And they are formed from different types of environments. The Kruger Park doesn't really have a lot because there's a lot of floodplains.
Yeah.
But there are mountain areas. So if you're looking at rocks, you need to go and look for rocks. And that's different areas such as Barberton. And those areas with the old, what's called ancient rocks, from greenstones and gold and all the rest of it, that you can see. But if you walk along a beach, I did this quite a little while ago, last year in fact, in the UK. I walked along the beach and there's a million pebbles. And I saw one and picked it up and it was a fossil.
Wow.
It'd been lying there, a beautiful fossil. Of, and no one's seen it. Now, you're not supposed to take fossils. Yeah, but it was in a car park, would you believe? Not on the... It was the area where the cars parked. But if you look anywhere, you'll find something. That's the big thing. Keep looking. Make sure you look up occasionally so you don't walk into something. But look at the ground.
Yes.
There's a story to be had everywhere. Look at the trees, listen, and you will experience life in a way that you just don't know exists. Unless you've got headphones on and listening to music.
Okay, you know. So... Now, I think this next question kind of follows on from that. But now, looking to the future, Granddad, you've lived such a full life, followed your passions, and stayed curious all the way through. What advice would you give to young people today who are still trying to figure out what their dream is, or maybe too scared to chase it? What advice would you give?
Well, you follow your heart. That's what you do. But invariably, you catch the bug, the nature bug, from someone who you're with.
Yes.
That says, "Did you know this?" And they say, "No." And then you go back to school and you say, "Do you know that there's an armadillo? You know, and it's very rare." And they say, "What's it look like?" That's how something happens. But the big thing is you can show them a picture now immediately. So because they look at millions of pictures, including rock stars, it's in the mind and out again. You don't absorb anything. I think your ability to do your own reasoning is going completely. You can't even remember what happened a week ago because you don't have to. You do your studying. You have to pass an exam. Now, some people are very clever and can memorize everything. And they walk through the exam, but at that point, they never study again. So my advice to anyone is never stop studying. I didn't start studying grass until 5 years ago, different grasses and their uses, when I was reading about the felt and the original farmers, how they could recognize the sour grasses and so on. Now I can tell the grass by the trees that grow in it.
Wow.
And trees have zones and they have certain soils, like silver cluster leaf. It's always, what is it? It's always in a band where you get seepage. No matter where you go in the Kruger Park, you'll go through as a little higher up and down again. Pick it up immediately. Not a good grazing area. Don't speed up if you're looking for animals. So nature is full of wonder. Absolutely full. Just got to look. Be curious. If you see something, say, "Why is that?" It's the same as we see a rock now. And I pick it up and I say, "That's not from here."
Wow.
We did that in the Northern Karoo. We found some manganese rocks. And after I'd studied them, we found there was a geologist living there for a while, and he broke up rocks and he left them there. I've still got them. Beautiful. But they're from the Kalahari manganese mines. Totally distinct. Can't be from anywhere else. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think everyone listening to this can agree that I have an exceptional granddad, and he knows lots, and he's got many, many talents. I'm just sitting here in awe, like I'm speechless, because you know so much, and I think that is something that, it's sad to say, but we're losing in these next generations because of social media. And yes, there's the two sides where social media is good because it spreads awareness and stuff, and it's easier to kind of get that knowledge. But also, I don't think we're getting out as much as like you used to. And then you were, like you said in the beginning of this podcast, you were kind of forced to learn nature because otherwise you'd get yourself in a pretty sticky situation.
Well, yeah, it's a good point. When you get interested in something, your mind gets curious.
Yes.
And you start saying, why is this? Why is that? A particular situation such as trees, you begin to look at the fact that the environment... I'll give you a quick example on this, that in a factory down here that I used to work, there is a river bush willow, a giant river bush willow.
Yes.
Now, if you look in all of the books today, the bush willow tends to be all north and always on streams. And when I first saw this, I thought, that shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
When I inquired in the Dendrological Society, which I was also a member of, they said, no, there's no bush willows unless they're artificially planted. I said, this is big. This is 40, 30 metres. And they didn't believe me. And then I decided this has been here for 100 or so years before Vereeniging.
Wow.
So what I did, I found old maps and followed drainage lines. And a stream went right where that tree is, and they put drainage in and taken the stream all the way around. So that tree, fortunately it was big enough, is totally unique. It's not in the wrong area. We have moved its water supply because we built roads across in front of it. And that's an example of how we interfere with the environment.
Yes.
But the environment is very resilient, and given a good go, it'll beat us. But at any time, someone will cut that down, not knowing what it is.
And that's the unfortunate part of it.
So that's really study detail. Get excited by talking to other people who study detail.
Yes.
Otherwise, they look at you and say, oh, I don't want to know this. Yeah, yeah. And you will get a new spice to your life. Not that I didn't do the rock stuff and all the teenage hippie stuff. I did all that. But I soon got fed up of it.
Yeah.
I lost my hearing because of it. You know. But then it was every year, take on a new challenge. Take on something new. Play an instrument. Do something to keep the brain going. And I really believe many years ago, when I was in the States, I met a professor. And he said to me, if you let your brain slow down, your body will go with it. And that is so true. So true. So you lose brain cells, but you've still got more brain cells than you ever need. And, you know, I learned computer programming in the early days in BASIC and so on, which I found fascinating. But it wasn't long before you didn't have to. You've got programs writing programs.
Yes.
You've got AI now that actually will reproduce me talking, which is sad.
Yeah, it is sad.
Because I haven't seen that AI can really produce emotion.
That is so true.
And that is something that I'm sure they will solve at some time. But it's far more fun to find something out for yourself. Be curious, find something out. And there are still people now in the mineral society, particularly in America, who pick up a stone they've never done before, and they come on the internet and say, can you please help me? What is this? You know, so there are people who suddenly are looking at new things.
Yes.
And those new things stimulate you for the future. The big difference, I think, between people today, and it's only based on people that have done studying for many years at universities, chemists and so on, that they now are more specialised. They're exceptionally good, like the medical profession, in one area.
Yes.
But not a broad knowledge now is rare to find.
And I 100% agree. I don't think there's much I can add to kind of validate your point more, because I think you've done a very good job at doing that. But now, before we come to a close, let's shoot with a quick fire round.
Okay.
It's time for some bush picks. So here, there's no thinking too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Just say the first thing that comes
yeah.
to mind. Okay, let's go. So, favorite bird of all time?
Favorite bird of all time? Malachite kingfisher,
okay.
I think.
Favorite Kruger rest camp?
Balula.
Mm-hmm. Best
when it was a rest camp, not now. Yeah.
Best time of day in the bush, sunrise or sunset?
Sunset for photography, sunrise for the birds.
Okay, I agree with that. Bush walk or game drive?
I've done so many. The one I enjoyed the most was the bush walk in Botswana. It was more open, so you could see lions and elephant from a mile away. So you didn't have to get too close to them. That was a different experience. And the same as the Namib Desert. I've walked the Namib Desert. And
wow.
I've walked the Arizona Desert for a day on my own. And the scenery, it's all different. But that's because they're different.
Mm.
I would very much like to go see the ice fields and things like that. That I haven't done.
Well, you've still got time. But now moving on with the rest of the quick fire questions.
Yes.
Binox or camera?
Binox first.
Okay. You didn't really hesitate with that one. One animal you never get tired of seeing?
Pangolin.
How many pangolins have you seen?
Two.
Wow. Okay.
And all of them 50 years ago. I've even picked one up.
Wow.
When it was coiled up and held. And I've got a photograph of it.
Wow.
Because it's stopped in the road and it coiled up.
Mm.
But I didn't know at that time how precious that was. I do now.
Mm. Very precious. Mm. Most underrated bird?
Most underrated bird? Wow.
Is that a hard one?
No, it's a silly one, actually. It's a swan.
A swan?
Yeah. Yeah. People look at them and don't take any notice, oh, that's pretty, but they don't realise that if it wasn't for human interference, they'd all be gone a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
There's the first, as far as I know, the first protected bird in Europe.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's why the queen, all the swans belong to the queen as it did, and they have swan upping, and no one's allowed to touch them. Swan upping is when they go and they ring all the birds in London. And that's been going on since Henry VIII.
Wow.
Because a swan, they did cook them at one time. And that's when they realised that there'd be none left. They're too easy to get to.
Yes, they are.
So that's a bird that I've always loved, all the way back.
Interesting. We just got a bit of a history lesson there. Favourite season in the bush, dry or green?
Spring.
Okay, so like flowers, like a bit of greenery then.
Yeah, because that's the time. First of all, when you see the migrant birds coming in.
Mm.
And the other thing is you can identify the trees and the bushes by their colours when they come out.
Yes.
Such as the pomegranate tree comes out
very
yellow.
Mm.
You can pick them up miles away. And the broad-leaved teak has got a yellow flower on before it has leaves.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, field guide, brand new or well-worn and scribbled in?
The well-worn and scribbled one I look at every so often to see how many birds that I actually saw in the Kruger Park.
Okay.
And at that time, I couldn't photograph them. I just identified them.
Mm.
But then when I got more interested in it, I started buying much more specialised, like the raptors and the ducks. You know, but I don't do as much now because I'm usually alone.
Mm.
So I concentrate on what I can find, which is on the ground and around me.
Okay.
You know, and finding trees in strange places.
Yes.
You know, that's, yeah.
Yeah. Big cats or birds of prey?
Oh, always birds of prey.
Okay.
Big cats.
Not that interesting.
No.
Okay. Favourite animal sound in the bush?
Hyena.
That's a good one. Campfire chats or early morning drives?
If you're with the right people, campfire chats are brilliant.
Yes.
But early morning drives, I don't generally get so excited because you never quite see what you expect to. You do if you do it enough, but you come back freezing cold, ready for breakfast.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You like breakfast.
Yeah. Breakfast essential.
One word that describes the bush for you. Summarize it in one word.
Paradise.
I like that. Okay. Granddad, thank you for sharing your stories with us. I think my grandfather is like David Attenborough. I don't know. People let me know. But I know this isn't something you usually do. But sitting down with you today felt a bit like flipping through one of your old field guides, full of care, quiet moments, and memories that linger long after the page is turned. So to everyone listening, I hope this episode reminds you to slow down, pay attention, and make space for the kind of memories that don't need to be written down to be remembered. So thank you, Granddad.
And share them with family.
Yes.
That's the big thing.
Yes.
Thank you.
Pleasure. So thanks for joining us on this special journey. We'll be back soon with more voices, more stories, and more wild moments. Until next time, this is Gabby Sikora for the Wild Eye Podcast.